episode 11, and in this episode, we will be finishing the chapter Golden Autumn. So, my dear Buddhas, we are going to be reading from pages 201 to 216. Let's start. Kiyoshi Jujo and the others, who had gone to have a look around the Toronto Central City area, came back to the hotel early that evening. They were accompanied by a middle-aged Japanese man, a Sokogakai member who, as president of a trading company, spent 6 months of each year in Montreal on business. When he learned that President Yamamoto would be visiting Toronto, the man had decided to go and meet him, making a 10-hour bus journey from Montreal. Shinichi spoke with the businessman for some time. He was delighted that a fellow member had shown up here in Canada, where he had expected to find none, and that this person had travelled specially from Montreal just to see him. Shinichi asked the man about conditions in that Canadian city. The man explained that Christianity was deeply rooted in every aspect of society and explained how difficult it was to spread a correct understanding of Buddhism among people under such circumstances. Though he gave an objective appraisal of the situation in Montreal, his words failed to impart any sense of what he himself would do to challenge these obstacles as an active player in the Kosun Rufu movement. "I guess we'll have to postpone Kosun Rufu in Montreal then," Shinichi said. "Wherever it may be, the advancement of Kosun Rufu depends on the presence of one person with the lion's courage to stand alone. Without someone who is determined to boldly confront all obstacles and take on full responsibility for Kosun Rufu, there can be no progress or development." Shinichi thought, "Difficulty and hardship are part and parcel of blazing new trails. If we think something is difficult, then it will be difficult. And if we think something is impossible, then it will be impossible. The path to Kosun Rufu, however, can be forged only with a burning fighting spirit and a passionate struggle to pierce through all obstacles that stand in our way." But Shinichi held back from expressing these thoughts. He had placed his hopes on this man who could be described as a solitary seed of Kosun Rufu in Canada. Yet, Shinichi felt hesitant to instruct him on the strict path of faith that required lion-like courage. This member had obviously had no opportunity to learn the Soka Gakkai's standalone spirit. Shinichi thanked the member who had travelled all the way to Toronto to see him and offered words of encouragement. After they had said goodbye, Shinichi prayed that the man would be a victor in faith, practicing steadfastly throughout his life. Through this encounter, Shinichi realized that he would have to wait for the appropriate time for the curtain to rise on the Kosun Rufu movement in Canada, for a time when a steady stream of like-minded friends, whose mission in this life was to realize the widespread propagation of the Daishonin's Buddhism, would emerge and develop one after another. It was thus in Toronto that Shinichi Yamamoto ushered in the morning of October 12, 1960. Despite his ill health, Shinichi's heart overflowed with fresh resolve for Kosun Rufu. That day, riding in a car driven by Nagayasu Masaki, the group visited various sites in Toronto to inspect possible construction materials for the Daikya Kuden Grand Reception Hall. Afterwards, they went to Niagara Falls, located midway along the Niagara River, which flows between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, along the border between the United States and Canada. Stepping from the car, Shinichi and the others were struck by the thunderous, almost earth-shattering roar of the giant falls that spread before them, its waters crashing down to churn up great clouds of spray. Niagara Falls was split in two by Goat Island, a small island lying in the middle of the Niagara River. The crests of the falls on both sides were several hundred meters in length, and the sight of water plummeting over sheer drops of around 50 meters was truly spectacular. Shinichi was entranced by the breathtaking beauty of this natural phenomenon. He sat down on the stone fence that ran along the edge of the cliff overlooking the river. Set off by a magnificent clear blue sky and the distant forest cloaked in a colorful autumn hues, The falls shone with pristine brilliance as the water thundered down with powerful intensity. Mist from the crashing water danced into the air, creating a vivid rainbow. To Shinichi, the monumental and unceasing flow of water seemed somehow symbolic of the advance of Kosenryufu, while the shimmering rainbow it gave rise to represented boundless hope. As he gazed at the majestic sight, he said with deep feeling to Aisuke Akizuki, who stood next to him, "The rainbow above this waterfall would disappear in an instant if the flow of water were to stop. Similarly, the rainbow of hope in our lives shines only when we advance energetically towards Kosenryufu. People who never lose hope have the strength to remain undefeated by any difficulty. Once a person loses hope, however, life becomes dark. Despair is the same as spiritual death. Youth must live with constant and unflagging hope. I want to create a rainbow of hope in the hearts of the world's youth." Akizuki, the Soka Gakkai Youth Division Chief, could feel in Shinichi's words his boundless compassion and fervent expectation for young people. He thought how fortunate he and the other members of the youth division were to practice together with such a leader. By the time the group returned to the hotel, darkness had fallen. Shinichi went to the front desk to pick up his room key and then sat on a sofa in the lobby, where he casually reached for a local newspaper lying nearby. What he saw made him gasp. "That's Chairman Asanuma of the Socialist Party." The paper carried a photograph of Inejiro Asanuma being attacked by a knife-wielding youth wearing a loose jacket over a school uniform. The picture actually captured Asanuma, his glasses askew, as he was about to crumble to the floor. Nagayasu Masaki hurriedly translated the accompanying article for Shinichi. It says that at shortly past 3 p.m. Japan time on October 12th, Mr. Asanuma, chairman of the Japan Socialist Party, was fatally stabbed with a short sword by a 17-year-old right-wing youth identified as Otoya Yamaguchi. At the time of the attack, Mr. Asanuma was delivering a speech at an inter-party meeting attended by rival party heads from the ruling Liberal Democratic, the Socialist and the Democratic Socialist parties, which was held at the Hibiya Civic Hall in Tokyo. The other leaders from Japan gazed in shock at the picture in the paper. "How horrible," said Shinichi. He chanted three daimoku in his heart and prayed for the repose of the deceased politician. Although Shinichi had never met Asanuma personally, and their philosophies and beliefs naturally differed, the late Socialist Party chairman's affinity for the common people and his energetic actions struck a chord of sympathy within him. Despite serving in such top party posts as Secretary General and later Chairman, Inejiro Asanuma had maintained his residence in a humble apartment in Shirakawa-cho in Fukagawa, Tokyo, living a very simple and modest lifestyle. He travelled energetically around Japan, marched at the head of demonstrations, and made it his motto to always fight alongside the people, activities that had earned him the nickname the Human Dynamo. Shinichi was deeply saddened that a person like Asanuma should have been felled by a terrorist's knife. He deplored this cruel and inhumane crime. He also felt intense pity for the young assailant who had sunk into the dark depths of terrorism. In that same year, there had been a number of similar incidents of senseless violence related to the ratification of the new US-Japan Security Treaty. On June 17, a 20-year-old youth, armed with a knife, had entered the National Diet compound and stabbed Jotaro Kawakami, a member of the House of Representatives and an advisor to the Socialist Party, inflicting minor injury. Then, in the following month, on July 14, Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi also sustained minor wounds when he was attacked at his official residence by a 65-year-old man, the former head of a pre-war right-wing group, who was brandishing a short sword. The assailant in this case committed his crime with the intent of forcing the authorities to reflect on their conduct, convinced that the uproar over the new security treaty pointed to problems with the way the government was running the country. At first, no one believed that the assassination of Socialist Party chairman Asanuma was the work of a lone 17-year-old youth. Police investigators took the view that other shadowy figures had masterminded the attack. Suspicion fell on members of a right-wing organization with which Otoya Yamaguchi had once been affiliated. Much to everyone's surprise, however, it later came to light that the youth, although influenced by the organization ideologically, had planned and carried out the assassination on his own. It was reported that he had been a well-mannered young man who was gentle and pure of heart. His father was an officer in Japan's self-defense forces. His early adolescence coincided with a time when the very existence of the self-defense forces was harshly criticized by the left wing. Given these conditions, it is not at all surprising that an anti-communist attitude should gradually have grown in his heart. One day, the youth happened to hear a speech given by a right-wing leader. The speaker declared that the Soviet Union and China were aiming to spread communism in Japan. Their henchmen in this endeavor, he claimed, were the members of the Japan Communist Party, the Japan Socialist Party, the labor unions, the Zengakuren, which is the All Japan Federation of Student Self-Governing Associations, and other groups. Pointing to the corruption and degeneracy of conservative politicians, he asserted that Japan was now standing on the brink of revolution. Demanding that resolute action be taken to bring about a political restoration, the leader called on the youth of Japan to rise up. This passionate appeal, which rang with clarity and simplicity, rocked the young man to the very core of his being. He voluntarily joined a right-wing organization and became an active member. In the meantime, the anti-security treaty movement was beginning to grow in scope. The young man participated in rightist activities to oppose anti-security treaty rallies and protest meetings, and he was always one of the first to storm the demonstrators. He was arrested time and again. As the anti-security treaty movement broadened and intensified, drawing many ordinary citizens to its fold, it provoked a growing sense of crisis in this youth, who feared the outbreak of a communist revolution. He came to feel that because the right wing had far fewer numbers than the left, it would be impossible for it to gain control of the government by legitimate means. The youth was already dissatisfied with right wing leaders who spoke of toppling their counterparts on the left, yet never actually made any move to do so. As a result, despair and disillusionment washed over him, fueling his sense of crisis and panic. It was then that an idea began to germinate in his mind. The only way to protect Japan from becoming a communist state would be to assassinate the leftist leaders. He thought to himself, "I'll have to kill them myself." He drew up a list of several politicians he considered possible targets for assassination. Of these, he finally chose Inejiro Asanuma, chairman of the Japan Socialist Party. He saw this political party as an even worse threat than the Communist Party and was convinced that it was deceiving the people and attempting to sell Japan out to communism. In particular, he felt that a remark made by Asanuma, then JSP Secretary General, during a visit to China in March of the previous year, that "American imperialism is the common enemy of Japan and China," clearly exposed the Socialist Party's communist leanings. Yet, for the youth to embark upon and carry through with his terrorist plan, he needed some kind of spiritual support. He surely must have vacillated over whether to proceed with his plan when he thought of the suffering it would inevitably cause his family. Yamaguchi idolized Takamori Saigo, Yoshida Shoin, and Adolf Hitler. It was later found that a short time before committing his crime, the youth had borrowed a copy of the book Tenno Zettai Ron to Sono Eikyo, which means The Theory of the Emperor's Supremacy and Its Influence, authored and edited by Masaharu Taniguchi, the leader of a religious group known as Seicho no Ie, which is the House of Growth. The book stated that loyalty was the means by which to become one with the emperor, asserting that selflessness is the essence of loyalty. Sadly, these words seem to have spurred the impressionable youth in making his decision to proceed down the path of terrorism. He finally carried out his assassination plan on October 12th at a meeting where leaders of the three main political parties were to deliver campaign speeches in preparation for Japan's 29th general election scheduled for November 20th. Misguided ideology is truly frightening. On November 2nd, days after assassinating Asanuma, he ended his life by hanging himself in his solitary prison cell in the Tokyo Juvenile Classification Center. On the wall, he had written in toothpaste, "Serving my country with seven lives. Long live the Emperor." Back in the hotel lobby in Toronto, Shinichi was overcome by a sense of frustration at this news of Chairman Asanuma's assassination. It appeared that the youth had tried to force reality to fit within the framework of his own abstract ideals. Reality, however, is fluid and alive and filled with contradictions. It never conforms to the standards of abstract idealism. When a person's ideals do not accord with reality, the ultimate outcome is panic or hopelessness. It is not difficult to imagine that the youth had been overwhelmed by despair and a growing sense of urgency as he rushed blindly towards violence, fully prepared to sacrifice his own life. Many of the students who had poured their passion and energy into the struggle over the security treaty had become so weary and defeated that they were already turning their backs on the idea of achieving a reformation. Though the beliefs and arguments of those on both sides of the security treaty issue were diametrically opposed, Shinichi felt that they all shared something in common. He pondered the tragedy of those pure-hearted young people who had dreamt of change only to lose hope and be cruelly disillusioned, their spirits growing blighted and withered. Shinichi was keenly aware that it is only possible to create a new era when youth, with their dynamic power, sink roots into the soil of society and are allowed to flourish. It was morning and a station wagon sped along the highway. At the steering wheel sat Nagayasu Masaki. It was the car carrying Shinichi and the other leaders to the airport so that they could continue on to their next destination, New York. Masaki's face was covered with a fine film of perspiration. Their flight to New York was scheduled to leave at 10 a.m. Though the group had planned to leave the hotel at 8, by the time everyone had assembled, they were running some 20 to 30 minutes late. Masaki was doing his best to make up for lost time. With a road map in one hand, he drove at high speed towards the airport. But it seemed to be taking forever to get there. His watch showed that it was already 10 minutes past 9. "Aren't we there yet?" Yukio Ishikawa asked from the back seat. "Masaki, this isn't the same road we took from the airport 2 days ago," observed Aisuke Akizuki. Masaki became increasingly anxious, but as far as he could tell from the map, they were heading in the right direction. He continued on the highway a little further and then exited. Stopping at a nearby farmhouse, he went up to the door and asked if he could use the phone. He ran Malton Airport, now Toronto International Airport, for directions. He was totally unprepared for the response. The airport was in exactly the opposite direction from the one they had been heading. "But the roadmap says that there is an airport out this way." "Yes, that's Milton Airport, the military Air Force base." Masaki was aghast. He had been utterly convinced that Malton Airport lay in this direction, never suspecting for a moment that there was another airport with a name whose spelling differed by only one letter. If Shinichi and the other leaders missed their flight, it would wreak havoc with their entire schedule. Moreover, many members would be waiting to meet them at the airport in New York. Just as the time in Hawaii, when he realized that no one had gone to meet Shinichi and his party, Masaki felt his blood run cold. A deathly pale Masaki returned to the car and said to Shinichi, "I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong road. I'll turn back right away." After bowing deeply in apology, he jumped into the car, revved the engine, and took off again at breakneck speed. As he drove, Masaki could hear Yukio Ishikawa and Chūhei Yamadaira talking in the back seat. "Will we make it on time? It will cause real problems if we are late." "We might not make it." The words stabbed at Masaki's heart. He drove even faster. "Masaki, there's no need to be in such a hurry," said Shinichi, knowing how he must have felt. "You mustn't have an accident. If we are late, we are late." Masaki was doubtlessly filled with remorse over having made such an awful mistake. Shinichi wanted to relieve his mental anguish, even if only a little. At long last, Malton Airport came into view. Masaki grasped the steering wheel with earnest resolve, chanting Daimoku in his heart. It was already a few minutes after 10 a.m. when they arrived at the airport and rushed to the check-in counter, hoping against hope that the plane had not left. Masaki was gasping for breath as he told the flight number to the clerk on duty. "That flight has just left," the clerk informed him apologetically. The clerk was quite young, somewhere in his 20s. Masaki asked the time of the next flight and whether there were any seats available. "The next flight is at 12:15, but unfortunately there are no seats left. In fact, all flights to New York are fully booked right through to the final flight this evening at 10:15. Masaki regretfully told Shinichi the news. The party was at a loss as to what to do next. Masaki went back to the counter and explained their situation to the clerk. "That's a real problem. I'll see what I can do to make sure you make it to New York as soon as possible." After making two or three phone calls, the clerk left the counter. The group watched his retreating figure with anxious and worried expressions. "All kinds of things happen when you travel," Shinichi said, hoping to lighten the atmosphere. However, he too wanted by all means to avoid causing any more inconvenience to the members who would be waiting for them at the airport in New York. The clerk returned about 10 minutes later. Masaki looked at him anxiously. Smiling, the clerk said, "Please wait a little longer. I can probably work something out for you." A few moments later, the phone on the counter rang. The clerk picked it up as if he had been waiting for the call. He then engaged at length in what seemed to be a negotiation with the person on the other end. Smiling, the young clerk at the airport hung up the phone and informed Masaki, "It will be on a different carrier, but we've managed to secure seats for all seven of you." "That's great, isn't it? The flight will depart at 12:30 p.m. Please put your luggage over there." Masaki felt like jumping for joy. When he informed Shinichi and the other leaders of this news, there were relieved smiles all round. Masaki then placed a call to the airport in New York to ask that the change in their flight be announced over the PA system. More than anything, Shinichi was profoundly grateful for the young clerk's kindness. It was their fault that they had been late and missed their flight. The clerk was not in any way obligated to show them special consideration. Nonetheless, he had taken a warm personal interest in their dilemma and done everything possible to find them seats on another flight. Moreover, there had been nothing in his manner to make them feel as if he were doing them a great favor. Accompanied by Masaki, Shinichi went over to the young clerk to express his heartfelt appreciation. "Thank you very much," he said in English and then continued in Japanese. "I deeply appreciate your sincerity." The youth smilingly shook the hand that Shinichi held out to him. It was a handshake that communicated the warm spirit of friendship. Bon voyage, the clerk wished the group cheerfully in parting. Shinichi felt he would never forget this young man for as long as he lived. It is easy to speak of loving one's fellow human beings, but it is difficult to lend assistance to a stranger who is in trouble. All too often, people shun involvement by pretending not to see what's going on. It may seem like a small thing, but coming to the aid of a total stranger in difficulty is an act that requires human compassion and courage. The realization of ideals such as world peace and love for all humanity starts from the way in which each individual deals with situations and problems in his or her immediate environment. In any event, Shinichi thought it unfathomably mystic that such a person should have appeared to help them out of their dilemma. He keenly sensed that the members in Japan were sending Daimoku for the success of his overseas visit. As Shinichi reflected on the moving goodwill the youth had showed them, the plane rose into the air. The brilliant autumn colors of the maple leaves below seemed inexpressibly beautiful to him. To his eyes, the vast earth, cloaked in red and gold autumnal hues, appeared as a dazzling, richly colored tapestry of human harmony woven from the threads of sincerity. A renewed pledge for world peace resounded like a sonorous bell in his heart. That brings us to the end of the chapter. I hope you have a good day, and I will see you next time.